It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With all of our conversations about educational curriculum, policy, and assessment, what happens in the classroom between teachers and between students and students is equally or maybe even more important. This hour, we're going to talk about how to create an inclusive environment in the classroom and also in the workplace. We'll talk about how teachers and educators can learn to understand their own implicit bias and put that information to work in the classroom as well. My first guest today is Joel Geske, associate professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Iowa State University. And he asked his students about whether or not they felt valued when working on team projects. That question led him on a journey to make his classroom and others more inclusive. He recently published a paper on inclusion in the Journal for Advertising Education. He's with me now. Hello, Joel.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to visit with you.
And tell me about that question you asked your students. What led to asking your students about how they felt when working on group projects?
Well, it started out when I was the chairperson of the College of Liberal Arts and Science Diversity Committee, and that was one of the topics that we really wanted to address, was to make sure that every student felt valued when they were in the classroom and felt included when they were in the classroom. So we did a college-wide survey, and about 1,000 students responded to the survey. And out of that, about 16% said that at some point in their classroom experience, they had felt like they weren't included in the group project or their voices weren't being heard. And 16% maybe doesn't sound like a lot, but then if you look at every six students, one of those students says they don't feel included, and that just didn't seem right.
Yeah, that is a lot. So you get that information. Where did you decide to go with it?
Once we found out that there was an issue, we did some workshops for departments and teachers to help them come up with strategies that would help make every student feel more included in the classroom.
And tell me a little bit about some of the strategies that you have come up with. And I'm sure there was some trial and error along the way, but let's talk about the ones that work.
Well, I'm going to start by highlighting a couple of them that don't work particularly well. You know, the first idea that comes to mind is turn to your neighbor and talk about this, you know, issue, or, you know, come up with a plan, whatever it is in the classroom, and just turn to your neighbor. Well, if you think about it, most people in the classroom sit next to their friends. They sit to people that look like next to people that look like them or similar to them. And so if you just turn to your friend, you're going to hear the same kinds of ideas probably, because it's somebody from the same similar background that you are. And then there's always a few students that are sitting around the edges that nobody turns to, you know, and so there they sit without a quote, friend next to them, because they're different in some way. And so that doesn't work particularly well. So you can also, lots of times when you're breaking into teams, you'll have team leaders. You'll say, well, why don't you pick your teams? And, you know, if you've ever been in grade school and they were picking sports teams and you were the last one picked, you know, how does that make you feel? That doesn't make you feel very included. So that doesn't work particularly well either when you're talking about inclusion, because once again, most people will tend to pick other people that are similar to themselves or that are their friends or that have similar characteristics because they're comfortable, they're safe. So that doesn't work particularly well. Third way lots of times that we pick teams is just to go down the roster of the class list, you know, alphabetically.
Sure.
But when you start thinking about that, H, I, and J, you get a lot of Halversons, Iversons, Jacobsons, and kind of Scandinavian-sounding names. And when you get to X, Y, Z, you've got Zhao and Jing and Zhao and a lot of other cultural names that we don't have necessarily in our culture. So that doesn't work very well either lots of times, and you don't really get that intentional diversity. It's kind of a random luck sort
right.
of
Although issue. Randomization is something I see a lot of teachers using in their classrooms. They have random number generators and picking a stick out of a jar and things like that.
And that works. That can work. That's probably better than some of the other methods that tend to be used. One that I use, and it's sort of random, it's sort of chosen, is that I just have this big jar of colored foam stickers that are different colored animals. And as the students come in or maybe at their seat, they have one of these stickers. And some days you might say anybody with rhinoceroses get to go together, or another day it may be anybody that has a gray animal, so that you kind of have some randomization. But even those aren't as good as being intentional.
Yeah, let's talk about how you can be intentional with this. And I think from what I've read about your work, this is something that probably works better in a high school or university level classroom than it would in an elementary school. But how do you make intentional choices to put groups together that play to people's strengths and make sure everyone feels valued?
Well, I teach advertising courses, and so in advertising, we're constantly working in groups, and generally there's groups that are assigned by skill levels, so this is more university level. But even within a high school, or I think even lower than that, I've got this model that was put out by Workforce America, and it starts with your general personality in the center. It's like a target with four layers on it. And the first one is your general personality. And your personality is really affected by your life experiences and to some extent you're born. I think if you've got children or grandchildren, you can see personality developing very early on in life. Some people are more outgoing, some people more introverted, etc. So you kind of are born with a personality, but then it gets layered on. We have these internal dimensions that we don't really have much control over. They do change through lifetime, but we don't have much control. And those would include things like race, ethnicity, physical ability, sexual orientation, gender, your age. You don't have a lot of control over those. And granted, as you grow older, you might change a little bit. Obviously, your age is going to change, but your gender doesn't typically, unless you're transgender. Your ethnicity and race don't really change. You're born with some of those characteristics. But then we have external dimensions that you have more choice over: your geographic location, your income, your personal habits, your recreational habits, your religion that you choose, how much education you have, your work experience, whether you're a parent or not, whether you're married or not. Those are things that you have more choice over and that you can choose to change, but all of those affect your personality and your viewpoint in life lots of times. And so there's a lot of different factors. So I start by surveying my students, and it's voluntary. They don't have to answer a question if they feel uncomfortable. But trying to figure out as many of these different characteristics as I can, and then assigning students that have diverse backgrounds into groups. Because research has shown that just the fact that there's diversity in a group tends to make a group more creative. And in advertising, that's what we're after.
Can you, let's drill down on that just a little bit, because I can imagine some people thinking, you know, whatever. You know, they say that makes things better, but it doesn't mean anything to me. So can you give me a concrete example of how creating a more diverse working group also means creating a better product and increasing the creativity?
Well, there's a wonderful article that was written by Scientific America that outlines a lot of the research on diversity. And they came to the conclusion after looking at many, many studies. This was done in 2014 and then republished last year in 2017. But they found that working in a diverse group does come up with better solutions that are more universal, and also that it actually makes us smarter when we're working in diverse groups. So one of the examples they use is that, and this was some research that was done, they put people in groups and they told the individual that the person that they were going to be working with either was similar in viewpoint to them or opposite in viewpoint, and they had to try and convince. So two different groups here. And they found that when you were working with someone that you thought was diverse or maybe had differing opinions from you, you worked harder, you prepared better, and you actually came up with better decisions that were more universally accepted than when you thought you were working with people that were similar to yourself, because you felt like if they were similar, they probably shared a lot of your viewpoints. You didn't communicate as much because you assumed that they thought the same way you did. And so there was less discussion and there was actually less preparation done and less work done when you felt people were similar to yourself.
How have students in your class and in your school, how have they reacted to this intentional change that you've made? Have you done a follow-up survey?
You know, I have not done a follow-up survey. I probably should do that. But we're very intentional in my classes about talking about diversity. I hand out the Scientific American article, and it's one of our readings, just to let people know that if they want better answers, they really need to embrace diversity.
And just anecdotally speaking, how do you think students are responding?
Well, I think they respond very well. I think for most people, their intentions to be diverse are very good. At least in my classes, I find that they want to be inclusive. Sometimes I think it's just out of, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, it's just ignorance, you know, about what they're doing, that they're just uninformed and may hurt people not intentionally, but just by not including them in conversations or not valuing their opinions.
Do you see the classroom dynamic changing outside of the team projects? Do you feel like people are interacting with each other in more comfortable and meaningful ways?
I guess I don't have an answer to that. I haven't really noticed it one way or the other.
Well, stay with us. Joel Geske is associate professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Iowa State University. We're talking about his efforts to make his classroom and other classrooms more inclusive. And we're going to continue talking about inclusivity in the classroom, in the workplace, in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about inclusion in the classroom and in the workplace. My guest is Joel Geske. He's an associate professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Iowa State University. And he's been working on inclusion in his own classrooms and in the School of Journalism. He recently published a paper on inclusion in the Journal for Advertising Education. And we want to broaden the conversation as well. Lorenzo Baber is an associate professor of education at Iowa State University. He's also head of the School of Education's Higher Ed Division. And he's part of a grant designed to enhance U.S. leadership in STEM. And a major goal of the initiative is to encourage women, minorities, and other underrepresented groups to study and work in STEM fields. And he has some creative approaches to this. Hello, Lorenzo.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, and I would love to, we were talking about inclusion in the classroom, and Joel was giving some very hands-on examples of how he can make his classroom and other classrooms more inclusive using intention as he's putting teams together, playing to people's strengths, and making specific choices to put diverse teams together. Your research is different. Your efforts are different, but there's definitely a relation here, because when we talk about women and minorities being underrepresented in STEM fields, I have to believe that starts in the classroom. What are your thoughts, Lorenzo?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the classroom, you know, typically it's seen as kind of an objective space, but is not so much when you think about the outcomes, particularly in STEM. So when we look at students and the ways in which we may view them in terms of their abilities, assumption of success, validation of the knowledge, previous knowledge and culture that they bring to the classroom, some of those have an impact on the demographic disparities in STEM. Some students are viewed, you know, more from a scientific lens in terms of looking like a scientist in the traditional sense, while other students aren't. And so the classroom is the space where I think, particularly for community colleges, which our project focuses on, is the most common or most consistent touch point for students, these classroom spaces. So that's why the classroom and the faculty are so important in terms of transitioning and recalibrating our views on STEM education.
Well, and let's talk about your work. You mentioned focusing on community colleges. Tell me about your project.
Yeah, so our project is funded by the National Science Foundation, and we are looking at increasing the diversity of faculty who teach in STEM fields at community colleges. And our focus on community colleges is particularly important because community colleges serve the most diverse student body, because of the open access, locally placed, connection to communities. And so this project is looking at ways in which we can build the capacity of those teaching STEM and diversify STEM faculty at community colleges to elevate the aspiration among students at the community college and thinking themselves as scientists and the various pathways in STEM.
So diversifying, right, diversifying the faculty at these community colleges, that gives students role models, that gives them a way to picture themselves, possibly in a similar role. But why else do you think it's important to diversify the faculty?
Well, I think in addition to some of the things we've talked about and what your previous guest talked about, I think there is typically when students from diverse backgrounds or faculty from diverse backgrounds in STEM come into the classroom, they have an understanding because of their experience that they have some insight in terms of, again, building those supportive relationships, assuming success among all students, validating culture and knowledge that students bring into the classroom, and also understanding how demographic dynamics play out in the classroom, some of the things that the previous guest talked about in terms of both not only in the classroom but also in the labs, right, in the lab work as well. And so I think they bring a unique perspective from their personal experience, and then that gives them the opportunity to be more innovative and go outside the traditional norms that they experienced, as well as thinking about ways that they can scale up some of these innovative ways that they think about STEM and sustain it across their career, and not just in the classroom, but thinking about the ways they can shift the departmental climate as well as the institutional climate around diversity and inclusion.
You've said that culture of science is not inclusive for people of color or for women. What do you feel makes it not inclusive right now? What are some of the barriers that stand in the way?
I think part of it is kind of the culture of science, where the idea that it's about the science and not the scientist. And so when you think about the scientific method and kind of the objective nature of science, I think there's a confusion that the process of doing science is aligned in my from my perspective, in the culture of science. So to build an objective scientific method, there's this kind of culture of objectivity, cultural universalism that is not, that works against underrepresented students, and the results are themselves. So if the classrooms are, if you take this idea that STEM and STEM should be meritocratic and objective, then how do you explain the demographic disparities in STEM, right? So unless you assume that certain demographics are more inclined to participate in STEM or have more talent in STEM, and I think, you know, we can all agree that that answer is no, then you
right.
have to look at the climate. You have to look at the classroom. And then it starts in the classroom because, again, that's the central point, and the faculty and the pedagogy, the curriculum are key in terms of what is presented now and trying to shift that thinking in terms of seeing classrooms as an objective space because science is objective.
Well, and so you feel like, I guess what I'm trying to understand is we mm-hmm. have this idea that science is objective, and that's the goal. But, I mean, when a scientist is doing their job, obviously they're bringing their entire self to the project, their background, their base of knowledge. And although it's supposed to be an objective process, that has to influence it, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's it goes back to the earlier example in terms of, you know, this some of the assumptions and some of the kind of, I guess, norms around kind of science and, you know, having this kind of a singular scientist who is, you know, smart and has this, you know, innovative breakthrough. That's kind of what is the, how we see science in general. But in reality, it isn't like that. It's a group of people coming together from diverse backgrounds, seeing a problem differently, and then attacking that problem and collaborating with each other and challenging each other within that space, and coming to a conclusion that they can't come to on their own. So I think it's just a kind of breaking that what we traditionally see as science and kind of a singular pursuit, as opposed to kind of a more collaborative, and then most importantly, collaborative in terms of people's backgrounds, and because we know life experiences produces ways in which we see the world, and so the more or the more people you have that can come to with different perspectives, the more likely you're going to be able to come to a conclusion that you weren't going to come if you have a very homogeneous a group that has similar experiences and see the world similarly.
Right. Well, and I'm hearing you say exactly what Joel was just saying a few minutes ago, that when you bring a diverse group of people together to work on a problem as a team, that the team is more creative. And of course, scientific fields are also creative fields. These ideas have to come from somewhere, right?
Exactly. And I think the classroom is the perfect space, right? So you have this space where you can kind of work that out in a kind of training, and the stakes are not as high as if you're out when you're out in the profession, right? And so that's that working out and learning how to kind of work with others differently, learning how to both take constructive feedback as well as offer constructive feedback, looking at, engaging in a conversation and coming to a common conclusion based on that discussion. And I think the classroom space is so important. And then this gets back to our project. The leaders of that classroom space, the faculty, have to have those tools. And I think what we're trying to do is look at ways in which we can provide faculty with those tools to generate those conversations and kind of break the mold of the norms in science. Because I think that is where we're going to get to. That will help improve not only the diversity and inclusion, but also in our case, when we're looking at Iowa, place Iowa in a position where they can take advantage of these new jobs that are going to be created in STEM. And we know that STEM jobs are the fastest growing jobs in the economy. So it's both perspective in terms of diversity and inclusion, which is very important, and social justice and equity, but also it aligns with economic interest as well for the region and for the state.
So what are you doing to help get more diverse faculty into the classrooms at community colleges? What's the plan?
Yeah, so the first thing we're doing is, and this is an example of the great collaboration we have at Iowa State between the schools and colleges, and so the first thing we're doing is looking at our graduate students in engineering and in STEM fields, and just introducing them to the community college, because many students, come into graduate school and they're not as familiar with the community college. So introducing them to the community college setting, the unique opportunities that are there for them as potential faculty members. And then on the flip side, we're going to the community colleges and looking to see what they do now, and some of the both the norms in terms of pedagogy and curriculum and student development, as well as the innovative practices. And our hope is to, have these conversations on both among potential faculty members and at Iowa State, and then current faculty members at the community colleges, and see ways that we can or develop ways in which we can learn from each other. Those two groups can learn from each other and create innovative strategies, innovative skills, and most importantly, how we scale that up. And I think that's the most important, how we scale it up across the community colleges in the state of Iowa and how we sustain it beyond the life of the grant. So those are some of the goals that we have for the project.
So you're not just talking about trying to change the culture in STEM, but also this is a reaction to how our culture is changing with regard to higher education. Community colleges have become so much more important, but I can imagine that they're not necessarily on the radar of a lot of your graduate students.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this goes back into just a different faculty pathway, you know. So, you know, for the graduate student who's in the college in engineering and really likes research but really loves teaching, then there's an opportunity at the community college to kind of have a more balance or even have a more focus on teaching, that it doesn't have to be kind of research-centered, although it can. But I think that what we are doing is trying to diversify the opportunities for our graduate students and thinking about community colleges and also amplifying community colleges as a key space in higher education that has the most impact on diversity, inclusion, and social justice, as it's always been, you know, because of, again, open access, locally placed. You know, any person, anytime, anywhere in their life can go to the community college, and it's usually within a 15-20 minute drive or now online, you know, have new goals and elevate their aspirations, and particularly in STEM. So it is a merging of kind of what used to be silos into a more blended approach to higher education.
Now, I want to ask both of you, before we run out of time here, again, Joel Geske is with us as well, Associate Professor at the Greenlee School of Journalism and Mass Communication, along with Lorenzo Baber, Associate Professor of Education at Iowa State University. So I want to project to workplaces as well, because it's one thing to be intentional about inclusion in the classroom, but we also see these problems in our workplaces where people do not feel valued, do feel marginalized, and maybe don't stay in a field. I know that's a huge problem in STEM. So, Joel, I'd love to have just a quick thought from you about the lessons that workplaces and bosses need to be taking away from what we're learning in the classroom.
Well, and I think this goes both directions. It's also what the teachers in the classroom can get from the employers. There's been a survey that shows that one of the very top skills that employers are looking for are the ability to work effectively with others in teams. About 83 or 85% of the employers are looking for those skills. And so, as Lorenzo said, I think we have to start teaching that and modeling that in the classroom, because the students today are the workers tomorrow. And so if they learn how to work in groups and value diversity, that automatically should transfer over into the workplace.
Well, and in your field, in advertising, we've seen some incredible missteps in major advertising campaigns that could have been avoided with more diversity in the workplace. I mean, you have real
Absolutely.
World examples there.
Well, absolutely. There was one that I love. It was a Super Bowl ad from a couple of years ago for Snickers, and it's two guys working under the hood of a car as mechanics, and one guy opens up the Snickers bar and starts eating it, and the other one thinks it looks good and starts eating it from the other end, and eventually they meet in the middle, and one of them, horrified, says, "I think we just kissed." And then he says, "We have to do something manly." And they open up their shirts and yank out chest hair and scream. And, you know, that got a lot of negative feedback, because it implies that two men kissing aren't really men, or they're not manly, or they're not masculine. And the original ad was a little more violent. One of them knocked the hood down on the head of the other person, injuring him. And it got a lot of negative feedback. And if you'd had a gay man on the team that was creating that, you never would have created that commercial. And it got a lot of negative feedback for the company, and they finally pulled it.
Right. And the diversity on the team would have prevented that. And Lorenzo, I'll let you have a final thought here. I mean, we do see that we see women and people of color leaving workplaces because of a lack of feeling valued or included in STEM fields. So what kind of lesson can we take away from what we're learning in the classroom right now?
Well, I think it's simply the idea that, you know, the best employers, the best classrooms aren't the ones that maintain the status quo. They're the ones that look project ahead, think about the ways the world are changing and adjust to the world. And I think particularly in STEM, that's the history of STEM. The history of STEM is not maintaining the status quo. The history of STEM is thinking and moving forward. And so that, along with the idea that we because of the demographic changes in our country, in our region, in our state, that we can no longer afford to lose time and talent or talent across time. And so when we think about, again, that STEM, the STEM scientists or the team of scientists, they can come from anywhere, anytime, any place in terms of
And we are out of time. But Lorenzo, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about inclusion, inclusion in the classroom, inclusion in the workplace, and diversity in STEM fields and diversity in all fields. Now, of course, education starts when someone is about 5 years old, maybe even a little bit earlier. So now we're going to focus on inclusion in the classroom as children go through school, elementary, junior high, high school. Feeling included and valued in the classroom is important to every student. And with me right now are Mandy Bozarth. She's Program Director with West Wind Educational Policy, and also Ellen Day Williams, Senior Leadership Facilitator with West Wind Education Policy. They've been working with school districts in Iowa to help teachers and other educators understand implicit bias and how it may affect their teaching. They're working with school districts in Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and Waterloo. And ladies, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
And let's start with a definition. When we hear the phrase implicit bias, that doesn't necessarily mean that much to everyone. So Ellen, you want to give us a definition of implicit bias?
Sure. The definition of implicit bias that we use in our work is from the Kerwin Institute at The Ohio State University, and it defines implicit bias as attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious manner.
Okay, in an unconscious manner. So this is, I can imagine that when you talk to people about their implicit bias, people get a little defensive because they say, I don't have an implicit bias. So how do you get past that?
Well, we first of all let them know that everybody has an implicit bias because that's the way our brains work. Our brains are always making shortcuts, taking shortcuts in terms of the information that we process. And so in that, there are going to be things that we come into contact with or things that we experience that are going to be biased in some ways. And so we have to recognize that those biases are there, even though they don't match what we actually think and believe explicitly. They're unconscious. They're just there.
Okay, so this is how we break down the world into
yes.
patterns, and
yes.
we recognize things. So saying, admitting that I have an implicit bias is not the same as saying I'm racist.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And we try to make that very clear. We're not about calling anybody out as racist. We're just asking people to look at themselves and examine the fact that we all have implicit biases. There's none of us that can escape that.
So then, once we recognize that we all have implicit biases, what do we do to understand what those biases are? Because everybody's different, right?
Right. That's a great point. Everybody is different, and we all have different experiences, and we come in contact with different kinds of media, different things we read, different stories we hear, and they kind of create different patterns for each of us. And so that's part of the interesting, I think, part of this work is working with, you know, different kinds of diversity in communities and different kinds of people and trying to find out what those biases are. We also, as a kind of starting point for this work, have a whole body of national research around what implicit biases look like in the PK through 12 setting. And so we're able to draw on those and to say these are some of what biases look like across the nation. And then to explore, might these also be at play in the schools that we're working with and the districts we're working with? And from there, we can really jump into using some specific tools and strategies to help people then tug at what those biases might look like for them.
So let's give me some concrete examples, because the reason you're working with school districts is because there's racial disparity between
right.
performance among students. So we've recognized a problem in these school districts and understanding our implicit bias, the teachers, the other educators, may be part of the solution to solving that problem. So give me some of the background, Mandy, that you share with teachers and educators and school districts so that they understand where this comes to play in that issue.
Right. So part of that is you're right on. It is just looking in the disproportionality we see for student outcomes and we see in student experiences and student discipline procedures that are in place. And a couple of great examples, I think, that really help people understand that is a study that came out of Yale, which looked at preschool children and how teachers identified misbehaviors in preschool children. So the way the Yale study worked, and Ellen, you can jump in anytime, but the way the preschool study worked is they had four kiddos, a white student, and I'm going to just make sure. So they had a white boy, a white girl, a black boy, and a black girl. And teachers were asked to watch these students, and they were given special glasses to monitor their eye movements to see who they were watching and to then identify misbehaviors. And so they found that while black children constituted 19% of the students in preschool, there were 47% of suspensions. And that's what led them into doing this specific research. And then when they had the glasses on teachers, they found that teachers who were primed to watch for misbehaviors, so told there will be misbehaviors, watched black boys 42% of the time.
Wow.
So they were really watching so much that they were misidentifying behaviors and misidentifying who was actually right. misbehaving. And I think that's a really powerful way to understand what disproportionality looks like and how implicit bias can sneak in if we're primed with all of these other stories and kind of what we call the fog out there, all these patterns that impede our ability to act on our core values.
And I think one more point in that study was that there were no misbehaviors.
Right.
But they have been told to look for misbehaviors. So it's that confirmation bias that you find what you're looking for.
Right.
And even though there were only 25% of those students that were black, the boys, 42% of the time, that's where they were looking.
So we talked earlier about how everybody has different implicit biases and everybody's different. Every individual is different. But when we look at our classrooms, particularly here in Iowa and in most towns in Iowa, we see that the educators, the vast majority, are white. So in looking for implicit bias, I mean, that's an important element of this conversation, right?
It's a very important part of this conversation. And I'd like to just applaud the teachers that are in this work because it is not the easiest thing to do. We like to say that it's courageous work for them to do. It's not hard work, but it does take a concentrated effort and it does take intentionality to make those changes. And you're right, we don't have that many teachers of color in Iowa. Iowa's demographics are changing, as you know, but in some of the places that we are working, there aren't that many teachers of color. And so I think it would feel different, I think, for teachers if there was a more diverse work group. But because most of them are white, yeah, they probably feel a little bit under attack, and that's certainly not what we want them to feel. We want them to recognize that they do some really great work and we just want to help them do it better so that all kids have a real positive experience.
And when you look at the implicit bias of individuals, do those biases tend to break down along racial lines? Do 40-something white women tend to have similar biases?
I don't know that I could speak to that specifically, but I just know that there's a lot of bias in our schools, and that's not just here in Iowa. I mean, there's bias across the nation, and we look at some of the data that we find in other parts of the country. It's very similar to this, that we have a disproportionality of students of color who are being suspended or who are academically behind.
So it's one thing then to recognize implicit bias, and I understand that that's not a simple process. And as you mentioned, it's courageous work. People have to be very introspective and honest
yes.
with themselves. So if you recognize that you have an implicit bias, you're a teacher, you can look at the statistics and say, you know, this is probably affecting how I interact with my students in my classroom. What comes next?
Right. So we have a series of strategies and tools that we use with teachers to kind of help them once they've identified, I think this may be happening. What do I do now? And those tools really help people to kind of slow down in the moment and start to develop some of those reflecting, self-reflection tools, but also to start to actually form new patterns. So we talk about these patterns that we form from all the things we pick up, the stories around us we pick up. So being able to start to consciously say, I'm going to do some debiasing techniques and start to create new patterns for myself. So using techniques like counter stories and some perspective taking techniques and I'm using big words now, throwing them around,
right.
But like individuation and being able to really look at your students and get to know your students in a different way once you've recognized a bias is a very different process.
Can you give me a concrete example of how a teacher might do that in the classroom, put this into action?
I guess I'm thinking about a teacher maybe looking at a student and recognizing maybe the story that this person has told about the student because it's a black student, maybe having thought, well, they probably don't have very many resources, or maybe the family doesn't value education as much. All of those things are maybe what is in that person's mind unconsciously,
right.
But it's coming into play as they're working with the student. And then they realize that this student is a high-achieving student, but they've never really recognized that until they sit back and say, oh, I've been putting this student in a lump with everybody else, and I haven't really looked at how this person thinks and how they perceive. And, you know, they really are getting this. So that individuation is actually looking at that individual student within that group and saying, I have to accept the fact that maybe my assumptions are wrong. Not all black students are underachieving. I have one right here that shows me that's different.
What about with misbehavior? Because every teacher everywhere has to deal with misbehavior in the classroom, and it gets in the way of everything else. But if you, you look at the statistics and you see that more black children or more children of color are being punished for misbehavior. So as a teacher in the classroom, how do you flip that? How do you try to make sure that you're being fair?
It's a good word that you use, because we use that oftentimes, flip it to test it. So if it were a white student behaving the same way, would you give the same consequence? Would you interpret their behaviors the same way? Because there's a lot of research that says that we look at black males especially differently. And so the other part of what we bring into the work is helping people recognize their own culture and some of the things that they bring with them. So it's not like you're going to recognize everything about everybody else's culture, but you need to know your own culture so you know what you bring to that interaction. So if you bring fear of black boys to that interaction, somebody does something, it's going to come in into play, and you're not even aware of it, but it's in there, so that's going to come out.
This process of working with schools is a long process. You're in year 3 in Iowa City. I'm not sure where you are with the other districts that you're working with. So give me an idea of how this process works. It's not enough to just say, hey, maybe take some tests, figure out what your own implicit bias is. What is the long-term plan?
Yeah, so I think, you know, all of our districts have different kind of ways they approach the work. But for everybody, we know that you can't just come and do this once and sit down and listen to something or take a test and it's going to be meaningful for you. So we develop it to try to be with teachers as they're working. And we're so lucky, especially in Iowa City, to be here for a whole year with groups of teachers and then different ones the next year. So we can really be there and talking to them as they're working, because we know you learn best when you're doing it in the place where you're going to apply what you're learning. And so being able to be there with them, work through these things, hopefully gives them a set of tools and strategies that they use for the rest of the time that they're teaching, because it is a continuous process. You don't suddenly wake up and realize you're completely debiased and you're never going to have an implicit
right.
bias again.
Because that's not the way life works.
Right? So
yeah.
Give me an idea of what you've seen. Have you been able to see success with districts that you've worked with?
I think some of the evaluations that we've gotten back have shown that we've moved the needle a little bit in terms of where teachers are. We know that research says just awareness alone is the starting point. And so that's a big thing in terms of making people aware. And of course, we're in a third year. So this is the first year we've worked with some buildings and some teachers. So the whole idea is capacity building. Where it's not a, you know, train the trainer program, but hopefully some of the strategies that we implement and we coach them along with, they'll be able to take back and use with their PLCs and their ILTs. Instructional leadership teams,
okay.
I'm sorry. Instructional leadership teams and professional learning communities,
okay,
where teachers get together and they meet and talk about data and talk about students. They'll be able to take some of these strategies back and try them out with their colleagues. So we're hopeful that when we're gone in 3 years, the program isn't gone. The implicit bias work is still going on.
For people who are listening right now, who, you know, so many of us interact with diverse communities in our lives. We all do, and we all carry this implicit bias with us. So on a personal level, I know you're working with education, but on a personal level, what would you say to someone who's listening right now who thinks, I wonder how this affects me? What should we all know about implicit bias?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing is to understand that it absolutely does impact all of us. So the very act of starting to become aware of it being potentially something that could impact decisions you make or actions you take is a great first step. So just letting yourself go a little bit and entertain that possibility, and then start to think about, I think, what those stories are that are all around us. What are we picking up as we're listening to whatever media we're listening to? What about, you know, the stories we're watching and the movies we're watching? What kind of images could that potentially be creating in our brains? And just start to think about that. And then, you know, to turn to some reading and to take some time to start to look up implicit bias. I think the Kerwin Institute is a great place to start to figure out what implicit bias is and how it might be impacting you.
And the Kerwin Institute, they have a raft of tests that you can take online, right?
They do. And those tests have kind of varied results.
Mm-hmm.
You can take them and you can often get results all over the place. So, you know, take those kind of with a grain of salt,
right.
I think. And I think the real work is digging in yourself and doing some self-reflection and making yourself a personal action plan of how you want to go about doing this work is probably a much better way than scaring yourself with an implicit bias.
All right. Well, and I love the idea of flipping the script. So when you have a moment where maybe think about it in a different way.
Absolutely.
Take a deep breath. Think it through.
Yes.
All right. Ellen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Mandy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Mandy Bozarth and Ellen Day Williams from Westwind Education Policy. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.